Morning. We're delighted to welcome you all to our last sitting in October. And our first case is 11AP2608, Michael G. Phillips versus Daniel G. Parmalee. Arguing on behalf of Michael Phillips, et cetera, et al., is Christopher L. Strobin. Mr. Strobin, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, fellow justices, may it please the court. I'm here today on behalf of the petitioners Michael Phillips, Terry Petta, and Walker's Point Marble Arcade to ask you to reverse the Court of Appeals decision affirming the application of the asbestos exclusion in this case. I'm asking you to do that because the exclusion is ambiguous. When presented with the facts and claims that we have here in this case, it does not bar coverage. One of the key points this court must consider in the analysis of this case is the initial act that caused the injury in this case. The initial act was not related to asbestos. The initial act was related to Mr. Parmalee's negligence in failing to provide information to Mr. Phillips and the Walker's Point plaintiffs. That information, an inspection report that discussed the probability of asbestos in the property. What happened here was Parmalee simply forgot to provide that report. At that point, when Phillips and the Walker's Point plaintiffs purchased the property, they sustained the loss.
Do we have any finding of whether it was negligent or intentional misrepresentation?
In terms of a finding of whether there was negligent or intentional misrepresentation, no, there's been no finding specifically in regards to the misrepresentation. The trial court found that there was an occurrence and that there was a negligent act, and then there was property damage, and then reached the question on the asbestos exclusion, and that's what this case has proceeded on until this point.
Why isn't there an issue in this case in regard to occurrence? That was very much the approach taken by the circuit court. It's normally the approach that we take. We look to whether or not there's an initial grant of coverage, and then and only then do we get to the exclusion. And yet it looks like all the briefing in this situation has to do with the exclusion issue. So I'm curious as to why.
The reason that is, Justice Crooks, because the trial court and the Court of Appeals did find that there was an occurrence and a negligent act. Those courts focused on the negligent act of Mr. Parmalee initially providing the Walker's Point plaintiffs a packet of reports prior to the sale of the property. We're talking about the provision of information in the case. It didn't have anything to do with the point where we reached questions of were there other exclusions other than the asbestos. The court found at that point when Mr. Parmalee failed to provide and forgot to provide that information that an occurrence was met. We had deposition testimony that suggested that, and that's what the court based its finding on.
But Counselor, don't you have a problem with that because the damages are not consistent with occurrence? The damages didn't happen until the asbestos was dispersed. But with an occurrence, the damages have to occur at the time of the occurrence, and the misrepresentation, there weren't any damages to Mr. Phillips at the time of the misrepresentation.
I would disagree that there weren't any damages at the time, Justice Rogan-Sackett. What I would suggest is at the time that Mr. Parmalee failed to provide Mr. Phillips and the Walker's Point plaintiffs that information, an occurrence was met, and they did sustain damages. They sustained damages because, as Mr. Phillips testified, they wouldn't have bought the property had they known this information at the time. Mr. Phillips and the Walker's Point plaintiffs entered into a purchase they would not have entered into had they had this information. At that point, there's damages under the American Family policy.
Aren't the allegations both intentional and negligent misrepresentation?
The allegations are, there is intentional allegations, yes. I believe there's negligence misrepresentation arguments and also negligence claims.
This case reminds me in a different way of, and I agree, we typically decide coverage and then you go on to have the liability trial. That's how it's preferred. But there are times when you can't do that. And I remember as a trial court judge having a case where there was a fire. And the issue was, did the kids set the fire intentionally or were they just screwing around and negligently set the barn on fire? And so in order for me to determine whether there was coverage, we essentially had to have a whole trial. So I said, I'm not going to bifurcate it. I'm just going to have the trial, and then I'll let you know if it's negligent or intentional. It was a court trial. Anyway, the long and the short of it is sometimes you can do it that way and sometimes you can't. And maybe in this case you can't really do it that way without having the entire trial. And so you look to the exclusion, because if the exclusion applies, then you know there's no coverage because it's excluded. Are you tracking with what I'm saying?
Yes.
To me, that makes sense as to why you would want to be addressing the exclusion regardless of whether there's initial coverage. I mean, typically you'd do it the other way, but I can understand in this scenario why the answer to the exclusion doesn't necessarily mean that there's coverage, but if it's excluded, for sure there's not coverage, right?
Correct. And I think, as you pointed out, Justice Ziegler, is with certain factual scenarios, the best thing to do is to have a trial on the coverage and on the facts and the allegations that are set forth in the complaint. And then you let a jury or a judge or some trier of fact set out what the findings of facts are and then apply the law related to exclusions or occurrences or whatever else raise the question.
But if I understand this correctly, if the exclusion applies, you're done. There's no coverage, right?
Yes.
And if the exclusion doesn't apply, then there's still the issue of whether there's coverage in the first instance, right? You still may be out, but you don't know quite yet, right?
Technically, yeah. There could be the application of some other exclusions at play here. If
coverage in the first instance, which is what my colleagues were talking about.
Right.
We're doing this backwards, but there's actually a reason that makes sense here, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Like the court saying, assuming there's coverage, you still exclude it.
Yes.
Now, I just wanted to point out that there are footnotes both in the red brief and in the blue brief. And they both, it's nice that you both agree on something. Right? And what you both sides agree on is that the issue that you have briefed, because that's the issue in the petition for review, is this asbestos exclusion. But that should you prevail, there are, as Justice Ziegler said, other issues. And the brief of American Family says that they would be addressed by the trial court or the Court of Appeals. I'm assuming trial court if it's a factual issue, Court of Appeals if it's a legal issue. Do you agree on that?
Yes.
All right. Should the court hold in your favor, do you want the opportunity to brief it in the trial court or court, the other issues?
Yes. Yeah, we had an initial set of briefing in regards to the case at the trial court level in regards to the other exclusions, the pollutants exclusion, and there are some other ones that American Family cited. But I think that if this court were to rule in our favor, I think additional briefing would be appropriate in light of what this court's finding.
Do you need trial of fact, too?
Excuse me,
you need factual findings and trial of fact, as Justice Ziegler intimated.
I believe ultimately, yes, we would, because there's going to be certain questions over the interplay of the facts here, because we have a unique set of facts here.
All right. We read them. Thank you. I'm sorry, Justice Crooks.
I've got a couple questions. One is, you started out by saying the exclusion here was ambiguous and doesn't bar coverage. Do you want to explain that to us, why you think it's ambiguous?
Yes, I will. Thank you. The Part A of the exclusion, I think when you take a look at the syntax of the asbestos exclusion in the case, and particularly starting at Part A, you have the introductory sentence and paragraph relating to bodily injury, property damage, and personal and advertising injury. And then we go down into Part A. And that clause can be broken down, and it's essentially two sentences, and reading them separately, reading them together, you can have a different interpretation of what they mean. The first sentence says, any loss arising out of, resulting from, caused by, or contributed in whole or in part by asbestos, exposure to asbestos, or the use of asbestos. That's a pretty imprecise sentence, in my opinion, because what that would allow to do is it allows for a scenario for an insurance carrier to come in and make an argument that some sort of loss that is touched on by another covered loss that is clearly covered, such as wind, fire, or water, if it's covered under the policy. If that damage comes into a play, if there's a covered loss and it affects a piece of property, a commercial apartment complex, causing a release of asbestos, or if that loss is somehow touched on it by asbestos, American Family or the insurer can come in and say, look, even though there is a tornado and a great thunderstorm and you have water damage everywhere, it looks like that you had some previously safe asbestos here that was encapsulated, but it's now been released and it's all over the basement. We're not going to cover that loss. I don't think that a reasonable policyholder reading that first sentence would understand that. I don't think it's drafted out so they can understand that.
Let me pause and stay on that sentence. Do you mind if I interject here?
That's fine.
Thank you. You say it's imprecise. I don't know what you mean by imprecise. Do you mean not specific?
Correct.
Well, then my response is I think it's not supposed to be specific. When it uses any, how many times? A few times. It's supposed to be pretty broad, I think. So I'm not sure that the complaint that it is not specific resonates. That's not the same as ambiguous. Can you respond to that, please?
I would disagree with you, Justice Bradley, because I think when you're dealing with a clause like that, when it says any, you're flipping over from what the insurance company expects as they're writing and drafting the policy, as this is what the insurance company wants when it goes out the door, flipping over to what would a reasonable insured, a policyholder, understand when they're reading this policy and trying to make an analysis on what they're going to do in terms of buying coverage. A reasonable insured is going to read the provision that says in the policy, oh, I have coverage for water damage. Oh, I have coverage for wind damage. Oh, I bought an old building. I have some asbestos there, but it's all encapsulated. It's safe. They're not going to read the asbestos exclusion. And they're probably not going to know exactly what they mean by asbestos other than what asbestos is. And then they're going to look and say, any loss arising out of, resulting from, caused by, or contributed in whole or in part by asbestos. Oh, that means anything. They're going to block that out and say, well, I still have coverage for water damage. A reasonable insured is not going to understand that. A trained lawyer might understand it, but a reasonable insured is not going to understand that.
But, Counselor, you know, when I asked you initially about occurrence and whether there were damages that rose at the time of the occurrence, you said, well, he wouldn't have bought this building if they told him there was asbestos in it. And so then you look at the damages of what was the building worth at the purchase price and what was the building worth if he'd known there was asbestos in it. But looking at subsection A that you draw our attention to, it basically speaks to what you were talking about. Property damage also includes any claim for reduction in the value of real estate. So that's what you said your damages would be on misrepresentation. Well, we wouldn't have bought this if we knew it had asbestos in it. How come damages that you believe are present here don't fit within that part of subsection A?
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a little distinction that could be made there in regards to the purchase of the property. First, it wouldn't have had any reduction of value to Mr. Phillips and the Walkers Point plaintiffs had they not bought the property. So I don't think that part of the exclusion.
Reduction of value is what you get in a misrepresentation claim. You get the value you thought you were getting against the value that you got. I mean, that's the damages that's established by law. And those are the damages. You said to me, we have those damages at the time of the occurrence here. But if you look at this, how is this not a reduction in value? I mean, that's exactly what it says. I don't understand why those damages that you told me about, which is differently than a different way than I'd looked at damages, but I give you that's appropriate. I don't see how it doesn't fit in there.
Well, I think I would ask you to take a look at the American Family definition of property damage. The initial definition of property damage is broken into two subparts. There's an A and a B section. The B section says loss of use of tangible property that is not physically injured. All such loss of use shall be deemed to occur at the time of the occurrence that caused it. That occurrence, and this is talking about loss of use damages, and those are part of our damages in our case. We've alleged loss of use. The occurrence that caused it was this negligent provision of information to Phillips and the Walker Point plaintiffs. So by the definition of American Family's own policy, property damage is triggered. This,
what about the definition in the policy here? Property damage includes any claim for reduction in value of real estate.
Yeah, that's what I was
due
asking.
Due to its contamination.
Right. That's what that part of the policy says, Justice right. Abrahamson.
So does that cover you?
I'm sorry.
Does that cover you?
Does that exclusion cover us? No. It doesn't at all.
No, it does. You say it doesn't cover you because you don't fall into the first sentence.
Correct. And I also, and the second sentence, that property damage doesn't cover you because that doesn't talk about the loss of use. The loss of use is is separately related in the previous American Family definition. And that's ultimately what the trial court and the Court of Appeals found were caused to be an occurrence in this case.
But if you fall outside the first sentence, we don't have to worry about anything else, do we?
Correct.
Right? So that's where your problem is, at least.
Correct. That's one of the problems.
Court of Appeals saw it.
Yes.
All right. It says any loss, right? You have a loss, you claim.
Yes.
Arising out of, sort of standard insurance policy language, resulting from, caused by, or contributed to. Usually you have three. This policy has four. Rising, resulting, caused by, contributed to, in whole or in part, by asbestos, exposure to asbestos, or use of asbestos. And you think it's ambiguous, if I understand your argument, because it doesn't say dispersal of asbestos. And what happened here was some worker cut the pipe, and the pipe was covered with asbestos, had an asbestos covering in part.
Correct, Justice
Abrams. And so you don't think the loss arises from, in part, by asbestos or exposure to asbestos or use of asbestos?
Correct. The thing I would like to piggyback on that point, though, is that the term asbestos, I think as it's defined in the policy, and it's not defined in the policy, is also ambiguous. And the reason it's ambiguous, because in actual practice and practicality reality, we have situations where there's old buildings across the street, across the state, business owners buying these old apartments, renting them out, that they have asbestos, and they don't all have to be abated. They can be treated, encapsulated. And I think one can interpret this clause with the language exposure to asbestos or the use of asbestos to distinguish types of asbestos that could be the one that causes the damage. You're talking about the accidental dispersal of asbestos because there's different types of asbestos. We have the friable asbestos and the non-friable asbestos. The non-friable asbestos is the safe asbestos. The friable asbestos is the asbestos that's release and is dangerous for inhalation and if it gets on the clothes. And the problem is American Family has an exclusion, at least in my view, devoted to asbestos, but they don't define asbestos at all. Why would an American Family define it? They make the point that it, you know, the Court of Appeals, I believe, made the point that asbestos is asbestos. A reasonable insured would understand that, but asbestos is a complex element. It's been used in construction for years, and you know, now we're beginning to understand a lot of the effects of it. But it's a type of element that a reasonable insured, a business owner, without some sort of degree of expertise, isn't necessarily going to know exactly what the dangers are or the different types of asbestos. That's why additional clarity is warranted in this case.
Counsel, I want to clarify, if I might, something else that you answered earlier. Several of my colleagues have talked about occurrence, and I know an answer to a question from the Chief Justice. You indicated, well, there probably have to be some factual determinations made. Is that true in regard to whether there was or was not an occurrence here? Isn't that a legal issue?
Justice Crooks, I don't believe a factual determination would ultimately have to be made as to whether there's an occurrence. I think whether some of the other exclusions may apply if this court were to find that the asbestos exclusion was overbroad. I think ultimately there would have to be probably a coverage trial on the facts of what caused what in terms of the release of the asbestos in regards to this property and what conduct is more culpable.
Relating to other exclusions other than the asbestos exclusion.
Right.
Does whether or not it was intentional or negligent conduct make any difference as to the initial grant of coverage?
Initially, I think it does, but the trial court found in this case, as well as the Court of Appeals, on the testimony of Mr. Parmalee that he gave in his deposition, that it was reasonable to assume or to believe that a mistake was made, and so that hasn't been an issue that's been discussed a great deal.
This was on summary judgment, wasn't it?
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. It was on summary judgment. There were some depositions taken of the plaintiffs in this case, Mr. Phillips and Mr. Petta, mm-hmm. as well as Mr. Parmalee. Mm-hmm. So we've been able to supplement the record in that regard.
As I recall the deposition, it was something to the effect that I filled out the form hurriedly. He was coming over, so I just checked no.
Yes, and Justice Brown, in addition to that, he said that my clients were under a timeline because they were selling another set of properties, and they were trying to have a property purchased within a timeline so it could be a starker exchange, and they would have some tax savings. So there was a little bit of a rush in order to buy this property, and Mr. Parmalee wanted to sell the property as well. So not only did he make a mistake in checking the disclosure box, we have a separate independent inspection report that Mr. Parmalee says he intended to put into a packet of information and provide to Phillips and the Walker's Point plaintiffs, but he forgot to, all in the rush. He wasn't able to do that. And that's the negligent act here.
There's no other question. Your response and your hypothetical regarding the expectation of the reasonable insured caused a question in my mind that I'm surprised I didn't think of in other cases before. And that is, your hypothetical almost reminds me of the Paul's Graf case that we all learn in, you know, first year law school. Who would ever expect, you know, and your hypothetical dealt with, if I recall, thunderstorms and lightning. You know, one of these things no one would ever anticipate. Here's my question. At what point do you assess the reasonable expectation of the insured? Or what is the focus of the inquiry?
is it, oh, as you suggest in your hypothetical, a reasonable insured would not expect that the water dam, would expect, rather, coverage for water damage, even in your hypothetical, when they bought the insurance. But is that when we assess it, or do we, because fact sometimes is stranger than fiction in our lives, assess it in looking at the language and saying, sometimes after the fact, what would a reasonable insured interpret that language to be?
I think that you have to look at it under the facts of that case and just generally what the insured would be. There are certain liability arguments that one can make and say, look, based on public policy, we don't think that this down the line is reasonably foreseeable. I don't think that that's a determination that should be made necessarily to cut off coverage. I think we have to look at what a reasonable insured would state and understand in the analysis.
Would understand what the words to mean, right?
Correct. Correct.
The words are paramount. The words are what this is all about, I think. Is that right?
Yes. And I see that I'm red, so I'm going to have a seat. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you. Representing American Family is Attorney Mark J. Mingo. Mr. Mingo?
Justices, may it please the court, counsel, good morning. I believe that counsel correctly identified the sole issue before this court, which is whether the pollution exclusion contained in the American Family policy issued to Parmalee and his LLC exclude the claim for damages asserted by the plaintiffs in this case. And I'd like to start off by commenting upon counsel's initial comment where he indicated that the key point, at least from his standpoint in this case, is that we are not dealing with asbestos. We are dealing with an initial act of misrepresentation. I want to bring that up at this time because I think that argument takes us down the wrong road. The exclusion that brings us here today has nothing to do with the defendant's actions. It makes no difference in terms of the pollution exclusion, whether those actions are intentional, negligent, or a hybrid of the two. The exclusion does not relate to the act. The exclusion, the asbestos exclusion, relates to the damages, irrespective of the act. If we look at the plain language of the exclusion, if the damages, not the act, if the damages arise out of, result from, are caused by, or contributed to, in whole or in part, by asbestos, the exclusion applies. So I'm concerned about the argument that the key point in this case relates to the defendant's actions as opposed to the claimed damages.
What do you think the key point is?
I think the key point here relates to, and I disagree again with counsel, with the undisputed facts of this case, which are, very, very briefly, properties purchased by one party, the defendant, is turned around and sold within a short period of time, approximately 5 months. There's no doubt that the defendant, before he sold that property, was aware that asbestos was on the property. Nonetheless, whether it was negligent, a hurried act or intentional. The defendant fills out a real estate condition report indicating there's no asbestos on the property. The second purchase is made. The plaintiff has a heating contractor, retains a heating contractor, who exposes asbestos. Mm-hmm. At that point, the damages occur, or the alleged damages occur. An abatement order is issued, and the testimony, if you look at Mr. Petta's testimony, you look at Mr. Phillips' testimony, it's all the same. The damages kick in because the property is ordered to be vacated. The state and federal officials order the property to be vacated. There's no income flow anymore, and the property is foreclosed upon. It's clear that those damages result from asbestos.
Okay. You keep saying the pollution exclusion.
I'm sorry.
There's a pollution exclusion in this policy, as I understand it, and asbestos, right?
There is a separate pollution exclusion which the courts did not get to,
right?
Because the case turned on the asbestos exclusion.
Yeah, but I'm going to get to that. The pollution exclusion talks about the discharge, dispersal, seepage, migration, release, or escape of pollution. That's different language from asbestos. Asbestos doesn't say any of those words. And here we have maybe discharge, maybe dispersal, maybe seepage, maybe migration, maybe release, maybe escape of asbestos, right?
Right.
So if you have two provisions in the policy, right, they're somewhat similar in the sense of they both deal with pollution. Pollution broadly defined, right?
Correct.
And you have a general pollution, and then you have a specific asbestos. But when the words are different in the asbestos, I tend to think maybe the insurance company meant something different.
And I would agree. I believe in this case the asbestos exclusion is certainly the more specific exclusion, and I would argue that it's broader, at least as it applies to this case, broader than the pollution exclusion, because it talks about any loss arising out of, resulting from, caused by, or contributed in whole or in part by asbestos. And as the justices are well aware, arising out of has been interpreted very broadly by the courts. The term arising out of has been said to include any action where there is some causal nexus between the damages being claimed and the exclusion. So, Chief Justice, my response would be that the asbestos exclusion, as it relates to this case, is much broader than the pollution exclusion.
Is it your position, then, that there would be no damages in this case if the property did not contain asbestos?
If we rule out asbestos altogether?
Is it fair to say that there would be no damages in this case if the property did not contain asbestos?
That's correct. That's the testimony in the case.
Okay. So you want us to focus on what could you pay damages for under this policy, and opposing counsel wants us to focus on conduct at the time of the sale of the property.
Precisely. And we did raise coverage defenses relating to conduct, which the lower court did not get to. There's an intentional act exclusion, which mm-hmm. was not ruled upon.
Right.
But for purpose of our issue here today, I believe the whole focus has to be on the damages, not on the conduct.
Yeah, well, you didn't really go into in any detail in your brief whether or not there actually was an occurrence here. And I was a little surprised by that because you could argue that the Court of Appeals should be affirmed on grounds other than the Court of Appeals ruled on as the prevailing party. And also, when we look at insurance policies, we generally start out and see, was there an initial grant of coverage? If we get a no there, we're done. If we get a yes, then we go on. And I understand that the lower courts got a yes on the first step, but usually we get all of the arguments to us anyway, regardless of that. So I was kind of curious why you just focused on this, but now I understand all you're looking at is damages. You're not looking at anything else.
Correct. And we did note in a footnote at the outset of
our I saw that. Okay. I saw that.
Yeah. Mr. Mingo, I've got another question that I almost hate to bring up, but I'm going to bring it up anyway. Is there a breach of contract claim here by the plaintiffs?
I believe so. I believe they're alleging misrepresentation and breach of contract, the way I read the complaint.
Have you, at any stage of the proceedings, raised the economic loss doctrine? I understand there's a tort claim, but now it's been confirmed there's a breach of contract claim also.
Correct. And our focus has been more on, and I think the economic loss doctrine would go more to damages than to coverage. And our focus, especially as coverage counsel, has been on the coverage language.
So you haven't raised the economic loss doctrine?
We have not, at least up to this point.
You might if it goes back.
Sure.
You've got a lot of issues if this goes back.
Yes.
That is true.
They're going to be busy attorneys if it goes back.
I would like to also comment upon, and I don't believe counsel raised it in his oral argument, but certainly addressed the four corners rule in his brief. And the suggestion was that by looking at and taking into account some of the extrinsic facts, meaning facts outside the four corners of the complaint, the Court of Appeals and the trial court violated the four corners rule. In other words, the argument is that in determining coverage, the court should not go beyond the four corners of the complaint. And I believe that to be a misunderstanding and a misstatement of the law. The four corners doctrine or the four corners rule applies to the duty to defend as opposed to the duty to indemnify. And we are all aware that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify. And the purpose of the four corners rule is to ensure that the insured is given an initial defense in the case. And I want to point out, because I'm not sure it was really emphasized in either of the briefs, that Mr. Parmalee and his LLC have been provided with a defense on the merits from the start of the case up to this point. And to argue that the four corners rule precludes us from going beyond the four corners of the complaint with regard to our coverage issue, I think is a misstatement of the law. We filed a motion for summary judgment at the trial court level, as has been mentioned. It's incumbent upon the appellants and any other party to this lawsuit who claim there is coverage to come forth with whatever, quote, extrinsic facts or facts obtained through discovery to oppose that motion. And I submit very strongly that neither at the trial court level, the court of appeals level, or today have I heard any argument that the damages before us arose out of anything other than asbestos. I heard an argument that there was an act of misrepresentation, but again, that has nothing to do with the exclusion, the asbestos exclusion that brings us here today.
Why wouldn't it have anything to do with the asbestos exclusion, given the broad, the breadth of the exclusion as you advance?
Because, Justice, the exclusion, the pollution exclusion, again, relates to...
Excuse me, the asbestos exclusion.
The asbestos exclusion, again, relates to the damages occurred, not the nature of the act. The asbestos exclusion has nothing to do with the act.
Yes, I guess I just misinterpreted your comment. And with that clarification, I understood it. I thought you to suggest that if there is an occurrence by misrepresentation, that the pollution, that the asbestos,
I have you doing it now.
It's all your fault. The asbestos exclusion has nothing to do with that. And I say, you know, well, if there's an occurrence, arguing if there's an occurrence, and arguing if the occurrence is by misrepresentation, then you get the damages, and then you see if this asbestos exclusion allows for damages.
Right.
Yeah. And I just heard you, I misinterpreted what you said.
I would also like to address counsel's hypothetical that he posed this morning, and it's found in his brief as well, which was to the effect that the asbestos exclusion, as well as the opinion below from the Court of Appeals, would preclude coverage under the scenario where we have wind damage that destroys property that coincidentally happened to contain asbestos, or where there is fire damage which coincidentally had to, which incidentally includes asbestos. And I believe the argument, at least as it was set forth in the brief, was that the asbestos exclusion, as well as the Court of Appeals opinion, requires no causal nexus between the asbestos and the resulting damages. So a hurricane or wind damage comes through, there's damage to the property, but fortuitously there happens to be asbestos on the property, no coverage. That is not American Family's position, and I believe that to be a misreading of the Court of Appeals decision as well. The Court of Appeals was careful to indicate in its holding that damage is precluded under the policy if it was caused in whole or in part by asbestos. So where we have wind damage or fire damage, the exclusion, at least the asbestos exclusion, there may be other exclusions that apply, the asbestos exclusion would not apply. So American Family is not here to assert that there need be no causal nexus between the damages and the event causing those damages.
So you say if there's a fire and asbestos is released and there's damage as a result of the asbestos, aside from the damage of the fire, you don't cover that. Is that your position?
That's
you had a lot of negatives, so I want
I've got it, though.
I want to say, do you cover the damages when there's a fire and asbestos is released, or don't you?
And Chief Justice, that's a more complicated example, if I understand it. This the situation where we have initial wind damage and subsequent release of asbestos, both causing some form of damage.
Right. And suppose we can separate them out, okay?
Right. And that would certainly be a case, it's not this case, but it would be a case that would require much factual development. But after all discovery had been done, if we apply American Family's exclusion, those damages initially caused by the wind or the fire, whatever it is, unrelated to asbestos, would be covered, at least as far as this exclusion goes. Those damages that were caused in whole or in part by the asbestos would be excluded under this exclusion. Does that answer your question?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have a very broad asbestos exclusion, is your position.
True. It's a broad exclusion, but I don't want to confuse broad with ambiguous. and maybe we should talk about that, the definition of ambiguous that we are all working with is that the policy language, if it's to be ambiguous, has to be fairly susceptible to more than one reasonable interpretation. And I, quite frankly, have not seen in any of the underlying briefs or heard today what language it is in American Families' asbestos exclusion that is fairly susceptible to more than one interpretation. True, the exclusion is broad, and I would maintain intentionally so, because American Family is not setting out to insure damages caused by asbestos or abatement of asbestos or any related damages. But I have not heard what words or what phrases in the admittedly broad asbestos exclusion are reasonably susceptible to more than one interpretation.
Well, what do you think the New York case that, Great American Restoration Services, Inc. versus Scottsdale, where the New York court held that asbestos was ambiguous, and that because it was ambiguous, it didn't indicate that coverage wouldn't be applied arising out of the unknowing or accidental release or dispersal.
I give counsel credit for locating that case, but that case really is not on all fours, nor is it even close to our case. The only similarity between Great American Restoration and our case is that they both dealt with asbestos exclusions.
Okay.
But as the Court of Appeals aptly pointed out, Great American Restoration dealt with a much narrower exclusion. The exclusion dealt with the inhalation of or prolonged exposure to asbestos and did not contain the broader language contained in American Families policy of arising out of, resulting from, caused by, or contributed to. So I think there's a very significant distinction between Great American Restoration and our case. The courts were interpreting entirely different exclusions in different language.
How do you want us to write this opinion in your favor?
I'm sorry?
How do you want us to write this opinion in your favor? What would you say?
I would focus directly on the exclusion before this court. I'd focus solely on the asbestos exclusion. I'd look to the test, if you will, for ambiguity, because that's the plaintiff's main argument or the appellant's main argument. And as the trial court noted, the trial court characterized this exclusion as rock solid and bright as day. The Court of Appeals found it broad, comprehensive, and unambiguous, and I would urge this court to do the same. I would emphasize once again that we are not looking at an exclusion dealing with the defendant's actions, that it makes no difference whether it was intentional, negligent, or something in between, because we're focusing on damages. And from a practical standpoint, and I believe this was noted in the courts below, it would be difficult to fathom how American Family could have drafted this language any more precisely or any broader to meet the asbestos damages it was intending to exclude. I don't know how else American Family could have written that language. If the the exclusion did not contain the words any loss arising out of, and perhaps used more restrictive language, such as in Great American Restoration, then I understand the argument. But Great American Restoration, I think, has no applicability here, and I am aware of no case law from any jurisdiction that has found invalid an exclusion, an asbestos exclusion, written such as American Families.
Last time I looked, the State Law Library had a series of books on interpreting various policy clauses. Are you familiar with the books I'm talking about?
I hope so. Please.
Good, me too. What about cases there? That's what triggered my question, is you say you don't know of any case, so I'm assuming you looked at that book or a comparable book that collected cases.
Yes, we have searched for a case, a decision on all fours with this case, and I would agree there is no case precisely on all fours with this, dealing with an asbestos exclusion and using this exact phraseology, but we do have cases very similar to this. We have the Protec case, which was cited by the Court of Appeals, where the exclusion was upheld. We have State versus GE Milwaukee, where the phrase was the exclusionary phrase was very similar to the asbestos exclusion in American Families policy. It excluded damages using the term arising out of, and that was the controversy in State versus GE Milwaukee, and the court found the terminology arising out of to be clear, unambiguous, and broad, and to apply so long as there was some causal connection between the damages claimed and the policy.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any other questions?
I would like to also point out that, and we've been discussing sub A of the asbestos exclusion this morning, there is also a sub B, which we believe applies as well. Sub B of that exclusion reads that this insurance does not apply to property damage with respect to any loss, cost, or expense arising out of or in any way related to the cleanup, removal, abatement, disposal, et cetera, of asbestos. And again, if we go back to what I genuinely believe to be the undisputed facts of this case, we don't have any damages in this case until the asbestos is released. Mr. Phillips is ordered to abate the asbestos. His tenants are ordered to leave the premises, and the property is eventually foreclosed upon. So the argument is Mr. Phillips could not afford the cost of abatement and lost the equity in his property. Sub B applies, I think, directly to that factual scenario, because American Family, by the very language of exclusion B, has excluded from its coverage the cost of any loss associated with asbestos cleanup, asbestos abatement, asbestos containment. And I think if you read these two exclusions together, sub A and sub B, it would be hard to argue that a reasonable insured would conclude after reading that language that he somehow has coverage where the damages, by his own testimony, arise directly out of the asbestos exposure. There has been no testimony in this case that there are any damages other than what have directly arisen out of the exposure to asbestos. And if I understood the argument proffered by counsel earlier regarding what I have just said, I understood the argument to be that a reasonable insured would look at the grant of coverage and assume that there was an initial grant of coverage, but either would not look at the exclusion or would look at the exclusion and not understand it. And to respond to the question that Justice Bradley posed to counsel, I think we have to look at the reasonable expectations of the insured when he or she has read the policy language. We can't assume that the reasonable insured can ignore the policy language and then claim it's ambiguous. So I think if you look at the policy language and you look at the intent of sub A and sub B, it would be difficult to reach the conclusion that a reasonable insured would believe anything other than, under the facts of this case, that damages are excluded, since by their own admission they arise out of the damage caused by asbestos. Are there any more questions? I'd be happy to respond. Other than that, that concludes my argument.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel, you have, Mr. Strobin, you've got 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'll make them count. The conduct in this case matters. As counsel was relating in his argument, the exclusion relates, I believe he referenced that the exclusion and the policy related to the damages, but not the actions. The exclusion does relate to the actions. It does relate to conduct. That's what Part A of the exclusion is about. It is just not drafted well. I believe one of the justices asked a question about, Justice Abraham said, I believe it was you, that asked about whether there are other cases interpreting this exclusion across the nation. I haven't found any. We haven't found any either, and the reason is because this exclusion is so ambiguous, so imprecise. There have been no other jurisdictions who have addressed an exclusion of this nature.
You know, I don't understand why you emphasize conduct, and I don't understand why you emphasize that it's ambiguous. It is very broad, but the insurance company has a right, does it not, to have very broad exclusions. They can have broad exclusions that almost give you no coverage unless the court then finds it illusory, right?
Correct.
So why here doesn't this policy mean if you're claiming any money from the insurance company and that loss or damage is anyhow, anywhere attributed to asbestos, any kind of asbestos, however you define asbestos, you are out of luck. What's the matter with that interpretation of this clause?
That is the problem that American Family has in this case. When you draft an exclusion this broad, once it goes out the door and it's offered to a policyholder in Wisconsin, it goes away from what American Family necessarily intended to contract for. That's part of it. But then it goes to what does a reasonable insured, a business holder, a policyholder expect when they get this grant of coverage, because once the insured gets this, or the policy...
What do you expect? What does the reasonable insured expect?
Correct. And that's the weakness in having something this broad, because an insured is going to be able to be more confused, misinterpret what the breadth of something means. They're not trained lawyers.
Okay, let's take a look at the words. Tell me how a reasonable insured
would interpret, go through that first sentence, if you will, that first sentence.
Any loss, right? You're claiming a loss, right?
Correct.
All right. You've covered that. What's the next one? Arising from?
Correct.
Arising out of. Okay. So, but tell me, where's the problem of the reasonable insured?
When you read it, that entire sentence, and together with the second sentence, the reasonable insured will look at it and say any loss arising out of, resulting from, caused by, or contributed in whole or in part by asbestos, exposure to asbestos, or the use of asbestos.
Yes, okay.
The second sentence at the end has in any form at any time as well. American Family attempts to bootstrap that in any form at any time to suggest that all asbestos-containing materials are excluded under this policy here. If you take that clause, you read it in conjunction with how they've outlined what asbestos is in this first sentence, exposure to asbestos or the use of asbestos, that implies that the asbestos has been released and is contaminating the outside parts of the property.
Show me the words. Point to the words. I hear your argument, but I want to know how your argument relates to the words on the paper.
The exposure to asbestos or the use of asbestos. There is not going to be exposure or the use of asbestos if it is not released. And if you contrast this with the case that American Family cited in their brief, the Protec case, and now that case, you know, American Family noted this in their brief, that case was not decided on the asbestos exclusion. The court made a comment in dicta that it would probably have found the exclusion okay, but the Protec exclusion is much more specific and much more precise as to what it meant by asbestos. If you look at that exclusion, the bodily injury or property damage arising in whole or in part, either directly or indirectly out of asbestos, whether or not the asbestos is airborne as a fiber or particle contained in a product, carried or transmitted on clothing or by any other means, or contained in any part of a building. That is much more precise than what we have in this case.
Well, I agree it's more precise, but isn't it included in the concept of resulting from, caused by, or contributed in whole and part by asbestos? That just gives you various examples of how it's resulted from, arose from, caused by, or contributed to.
Not if you're a reasonable insured who's not an expert in asbestos or not a trained lawyer. Trained lawyer is not going to know what in whole or in part means. I hardly know what that means. And I see my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank you, counsel, and you, Mr. Mingo, for your arguments today on behalf of your respective clients relating to an exclusion for asbestos. Pollution exclusions have come before the court previously, and how the insurance policies and insurers are to deal with pollution, whether asbestos or otherwise, has become a very major problem in the industry and in society. So I want to thank you both for your briefs and your argument, and that closes our hearing on 11-8-P-2608, Michael G. Phillips versus Daniel G. Permalee. And the court will take a short recess, a brief recess. We have some students coming in, and we will reconvene in a few moments. We are in recess.